From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's special edition of the programme, an in-depth interview with Ray Suarez, host of the PBS documentary Latino Americans and author of a book by the same name. We'll explore the history, contribution, and future of America's fastest-growing community.
You know, a lot of ethnic groups came during one concentrated era of migration. There was a run-up, a big spike, and then a subsidence almost to nothing. Latinos were here already when America was born, when it was in the cradle, and they've been coming steadily through the 18th, 19th, 20th, and now into the 21st century.
That's Ray Suarez on Latino Americans, coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the Veterans Day news headlines.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Many victims of Typhoon Haiyan are complaining they've received no support yet, days after the storm struck. Rescue and relief efforts continue in the Philippines, where 10,000 people are estimated to have been killed. The United States is sending supplies and manpower to the region to help the more than 9 million people affected by the country's worst natural disaster. From New York, Nick Harper.
The US is continuing to send troops and aid to the worst affected areas of the Philippines as the country tries to deal with the devastation caused by Typhoon Haiyan. Two US C-130 planes have flown supplies from the capital Manila to the city of Tacloban, the hardest hit area where thousands are feared to have died. US Marines stationed on the Japanese island of Okinawa are assisting, as well as rescue teams, airlift helicopters and logistical officers, all there to help in the relief and recovery efforts. Meanwhile, at the United Nations in New York, the Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has said he is extremely concerned about the impact of Typhoon Haiyan and has offered the UN's support to the region. Nick Harper, New York.
US Secretary of State John Kerry says it was Iran that backed out of a deal on its nuclear program at talks in Geneva. It had been reported an agreement wasn't reached at the weekend because of French concerns. The P5 plus one countries, the US, UK, France, Russia and China plus Germany, will now meet Iran again in the coming weeks to continue negotiations. But John Kerry, speaking in Abu Dhabi, said the lack of a deal in Geneva was not because France had reservations about what was being proposed.
There was unity, but Iran couldn't take it at that particular moment. They weren't able to accept that particular agreement. So hard work was done. Progress was made. The P5 plus one was united. There is a gap still between what language may be appropriate that they're prepared to accept. But the concept that we are all working on, we have absolute unity on.
Cambodia should have sovereignty over disputed land around the Priya Vihear temple on the border with Thailand, according to a ruling from the UN's highest court. The International Court of Justice in The Hague says Thailand must withdraw any soldiers from the area. The rift, which is long-standing, has led to clashes between the two nations who both lay claim to the land. India's mission to Mars has hit a problem after a planned engine burn failed to raise the spacecraft's orbit around the Earth by the expected amount. The issue occurred during a manoeuvre designed to boost the craft's maximum distance to 100,000 kilometres. A problem with the liquid fuel thruster caused the vehicle to fall short. But the head of the Indian Space Research Organisation says the spacecraft remains healthy and the mission intact. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Syria's opposition has indicated it would attend a peace conference in Geneva, Switzerland, but only if a number of conditions were met. Among them, the Syrian National Coalition is demanding that humanitarian aid be deployed to specific areas ahead of international talks with the Syrian government to end civil violence in the country. Our Europe editor Sandra Gatman reports.
Efforts by the United Nations, the United States and Russia to bring two sides of the Syrian conflict to the negotiating table in Geneva may be seeing a setback now that the Syrian opposition has come forward with demands. The Syrian National Coalition, who've been calling for President Bashar al-Assad to step down, say they don't want Assad to form any part of an agreed transitional government. They want their political prisoners freed and guarantees that aid agencies will be allowed access to certain war-ravaged parts of the country. The Syrian government previously rejected any preconditions for talks in Geneva scheduled for November,
Four men accused of conspiring to assist a suicide bomber who carried out an attack at one of Moscow's international airports in 2011 have been jailed in Russia. Three received life sentences, one more was sentenced to 10 years in jail. 37 people were killed and over 100 injured in the blast, allegedly masterminded by Chechen separatist leader Doku Umarov. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Islam Anilyes Yendiyev and Bashir Khamkhoev are accused of conspiring in an act of terror, murder and attempted murder. The brother of the suicide bomber, Ahmed Yevloev, received a shorter term because he was a minor at the time of the attack. They housed and provided explosives to the alleged suicide bomber, a 20-year-old native of the Rostov Republic of Ingushetia, who carried out the attack in the airport's arrivals area. The leader of a Chechen separatist group, Doku Umarov, claimed he had ordered the bombings. It was part of an Islamist insurgency's fight against the military operations of Russian special forces in the North Caucasus region.
And that's the latest feature story news. Ollie Barrett reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, a special extended interview with a good friend of ours here at FSN, Ray Suarez, until recently the chief national correspondent at the PBS NewsHour, now about to embark on a new journey with Al Jazeera America. We'll tell you about that a little later, but mostly we're talking to Ray today in his capacity as the author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. It is the companion book to a PBS series by the same name. Here's a taster of that.
The first European language spoken in what would become the United States, Spanish.
Immigration means it all gets to be part of your identity.
I can't believe it!
It's crucial that we know who we are, where we come from, and what it's been like.
I am so proud to be your mayor.
I, Sonia Sotomayor.
There's so much at stake for all Americans in how Latinos in the United States do.
And that last voice you heard there is the voice that you'll be hearing for several minutes to come. Ray Suarez, welcome to FSN Reports.
Oh, it's great to be here, Simon.
Let's talk about this Latino American project, and particularly the book. You pointed out in promoting the book that 5,000 Latinos turn 18 in America every single week. That's a stunning fact.
And that weekly number will persist not just this year and next year, but for roughly the next 15 to 20 years. It will add millions to the voter rolls, to the workforce, to the list of homeowners in America. It's going to really change how we think of ourselves and what we think of when we say, imagine an American.
And when you imagine that America, we're going to talk later about the implications of all of this in detail, but when you imagine that America and you look at a state, for example, like Texas, there is a substantial possibility that the political topography of Texas over time changes as that demographic alters?
Absolutely. The possibilities are there to pull Texas from being a dead red state into something a little more purple. We have to remember who the non-voters in America are. They are younger people, they are people with fewer years of education, and people with lower than average income. So right now, the profile of Latinos in America resembles that of the non-voter. But as these people age into their adult years, as they start more secure careers, and as they have interests in what the rate of interest is, what their local schools are like, real life will pull them into being voters. And Texas may be a less reliably Republican place in the 2020s, certainly in the 2030s, definitely.
Now, you call the book, and indeed the companion television series, Latino Americans. That's a grab bag title. I mean,
sure.
This is not in any sense a monolithic community. How difficult is it to talk in terms of Latinos?
It is becoming easier with each succeeding year. This is a generational thing. People my age with a little gray hair more commonly referred to either their national origin, I'm Puerto Rican, friend might be Mexican, or use Hispanic. But now people my kids' age much more commonly use Latino and much less commonly make distinctions between their national origin background. They see themselves as having something in common with other people whose family journeys began somewhere else in the hemisphere. They see something in common with each other where 20 years ago and 30 years ago, people my age said, well, you know, he's Mexican, we're different. And I don't think people have fully taken account of what that means.
And when you look at the younger generation, your own daughter's generation, I mean, when one looks south, one sees nations from which many of these people have emanated that do not always get along, that are not monolithic in approach. And yet, at a generational level, you think that there's a real change in the way the various communities in the United States are relating with one another.
If you go to the Upper West Side of Manhattan or the South Bronx, if you go to the near Northwest Side in Chicago, you have something that we didn't used to have. Mixed neighborhoods of mixed Latin American ancestry. There's a commonality of interest. There's a fellow feeling, more like cousins than brothers and sisters. But still, when it comes time to do politics, that's close enough.
And a community that is still shifting in a very seismic way. I mean, you make the point that in Phoenix, Arizona, for example, you can encounter members of the Latino community who can trace their roots all the way back to the conquistadores, or you can discover members of the Latino community who arrived yesterday.
And they may even have the same last name. The Lopez, whose family has been here 400 years, and the Lopez, who literally is drying off from crossing the Rio Grande. There's never been anything like that before in American migration history. You know, a lot of ethnic groups came during one concentrated era of migration. The Irish, the Jews of Eastern Europe, the Southern Italians, the Germans. There was a run-up, a big spike, and then a subsidence almost to nothing. Latinos were here already when America was born, when it was in the cradle, and they've been coming steadily through the 18th, 19th, 20th, and now into the 21st century.
You mentioned San Antonio a couple of minutes ago, and it's interesting because I was there recently and took a tour of the Alamo, and you wander around the Alamo, and you're struck immediately by not just the fact that the Spanish and the Mexicans were there, but the Germans were there and the French were there. And this sense of regional powers really competing to establish a toehold in the United States that then led to what we deal with today. It was by no means preordained that the Latino community was going to end up being demographically preeminent.
If I want anything to come out of this book, it's a more nuanced understanding of just that idea. That when North America's European incursion was still young, there were lots of big empires with their elbows out, wrestling for domination, pushing and rubbing up against each other. St. Louis and New Orleans were famously French towns, but also Spanish cities for a time, before they became American cities later still, and St. Louis was dominated eventually by Germans. This idea that the story we tell of America starts with crazy capitalists in Jamestown and grumpy Protestants in the Massachusetts Bay Colony who eventually just push west across this enormous continent, just reproducing England wherever they went. Not quite right.
And also this notion that you cite where people were able to say, we didn't cross the border crossed us.
It didn't
necessarily involve humans picking up and moving.
Right. You live on one side of a line on one day, and then the United States signs a treaty with Mexico, and you find yourself, without moving a muscle, on the other side of a very important line. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in the 1840s, at the conclusion of the war between the United States and Mexico, creates a Spanish imperial deposit culturally in the United States that persists to this day. And it's one that we're a little uncomfortable with as we try to think of America as an Anglo-American project that starts off with British common law and the English language on the eastern seaboard of the United States and then eventually goes all the way to California.
Speaking of that sort of celebration of the Anglo heritage, we're heading towards Thanksgiving. As the community grows in size, economic power, and importance, what are the implications going to be for the celebration of traditions like Thanksgiving that are very much rooted in an Anglo history of the United States.
I think people who worry about that kind of thing might be worrying a little too much. On that same day, as Mexican-American families will tuck into a turkey in San Antonio, and Puerto Rican families will tuck into a turkey in Brooklyn or New Haven, Connecticut, the turkey may taste a little different, but it's still going to be turkey. And that same day, they're going to watch an NFL football game on television, either in Spanish or in English, and cheer and high-five and bump chests, because how we think of assimilation and how we think of acculturation is going to be challenged, bent, streamlined, changed a little bit by this presence.
But it's not one-way assimilation. I mean, the family in San Antonio sitting down and eating its turkey may well be sitting down around the table now with an Anglo family celebrating some Latino traditions.
So far, that's kind of happening, but happening in the way that so many people go out and see the St. Patrick's Day parade and hoist a beer in a bar. It becomes a little bit of everybody's party. Immigration transforms immigrants, so they're not quite the same people anymore the longer they're in the United States, and immigrants transform America. It's a two-way traffic.
Let me ask you about some of the folk that you researched specifically for the book, because I know there are terrific stories behind several of them. Jose Marti, thought of here through only a Cuban prism, generally. You immersed yourself in his writings when he was living in the United States.
Jose Marti is a wonderful figure because on the two sides of the Straits of Florida, he's the subject of a tug of war. So Cubans in Cuba have an enormous national monument for him. He's the father of the nation. And Cubans in South Florida extol him and revere him as well, but don't think of him as a figure who in any way would condone the current regime in Cuba. So he's very attractive from that, you know, the way history can end up being a tug of war. Marti was a journalist, an essayist, a poet, a moving and beautiful writer about the whole hemisphere. When he talked about America, America, he was talking about everything from the Arctic Circle all the way down to the Beagle Channel. And in his journalism in the United States, he takes at first a very romantic view of this country. He calls it the Republic of Freedom, where common men can really feel like they are the equal of anybody else on the street. But in his 11 years living here, and taking a closer look, he sees, for instance, the racial norms that prevailed in late 19th century America. And he starts to think, maybe this isn't a model for my homeland. He wants to liberate Cuba from Spain, but then he worries that America will someday just simply swoop down and devour Cuba, as the country had already twice tried to buy Cuba from the Spanish Empire. So he has a very ambivalent relationship, even though Americans fill his coffers, Cuban Americans and Americans, fill his coffers with the money he's raising to fight the Spanish and drive them out of his home. A very interesting figure, a fascinating guy.
And another fascinating figure from the history of Puerto Rico and its relationship with the United States, Isabel González.
Isabel González is a great story because she points up the ambivalence that many Puerto Ricans have felt about the fact that they're American citizens, but also very much of Puerto Rico, very much belonging to Puerto Rico. She's a woman who comes to marry her fiancé in the first years of the 20th century. And when her boat arrives in New York Harbor, two men get on the deck, as with any boat coming from foreign waters, a customs inspector and an immigration inspector. The foreign nationals get off the boat and go to Ellis Island to be processed like immigrants. Isabel González says, "Oh, I don't have to go to Ellis Island. I come from Puerto Rico, where the Stars and Stripes flies over the harbor, where the United States fought a war with Spain to take the island and make it its own possession." And the customs inspector said, "You're an immigrant, just like any other immigrant. You have to go to Ellis Island." And they send her to Ellis Island. She's so angry that through circles in New York, she contacts people who take up her case And even after she marries her fiancé and her case becomes moot because she's fully legally able to live on the American mainland, she fights all the way to the Supreme Court, and in a precedent-setting case, establishes the right of Puerto Ricans to move to the United States, just like people moving from Michigan to New Jersey rather than people moving from a foreign country to America.
And, I mean, that is, in and of itself, a pretty astonishing civil rights figure and a pretty astonishing civil rights achievement, whose name is, I suspect, largely unknown to school children who do know the name Rosa Parks.
Well, it shows you that it's never too late to reclaim these people and bring them to new audiences. I say in the introduction to my book, if you're not saying throughout the reading of this book, hey, I didn't know that, then I haven't really done my job.
Let me bring this up to date completely. Immigration reform. The president has said there's absolutely no reason why we can't get this done by the end of the year. Can he get it done by the end of the year? And didn't he make a big mistake not getting it done during the first 2 years of his presidency when he was not facing a hostile Congress?
The people who are working hard for comprehensive immigration reform across the country wished that the president had moved when he had the House, the Senate, and, of course, the Oval Office, because they would have been able to get something passed. Now that is lost. He faces a hostile House of Representatives. He faces a country that, in the midst of the continuing jobs crisis, is not necessarily well-disposed toward finding a path to citizenship for millions of people. And he fought such a titanic struggle over health care reform that a lot of the political capital that would have been necessary to get comprehensive passed is now spent and gone. And given the way the launch of the Affordable Care Act is gone, he's not going to be getting that back anytime soon. So comprehensive may be lost. Republicans are suggesting piecemeal. Democrats are reluctant to admit that they can't get the whole thing. And in fact, when you're doing something like immigration reform, a lot of these pieces need to mesh and work together. So people who know the legislative game say, look, piecemeal sounds, from a political point of view, appealing because you can pass the DREAM Act. You can pass something that does border security. And then after that's done, pass something that allows for a road to citizenship. But a lot of these moving parts have to move in train with each other, and it won't happen if you start just picking off the low-hanging fruit and trying to get it done. The smart money now is starting to quietly say that comprehensive is done for this Congress.
Republican figures like Chris Christie, recently re-elected as governor of New Jersey, saying, look, there are ways we can reach these voters going forward. Can they?
They can if they start to talk about the issue of immigration and talk about the immigrants themselves in a different way. The numbers that are coming out of Latino opinion researchers say that Latinos who are voters, by definition, legally in the country and legally fully able to vote by virtue of their citizenship, feel that the Republican Party is hostile to them, doesn't like them. And you're just not very inclined to vote for a party that you think doesn't like you, doesn't like people like you. By using a shotgun instead of a scalpel, they have hit unintended targets. And even people who might naturally be Republicans, small businessmen, people for whom social issues are important, get that feeling, that vibe of hostility from the way that many Republicans, specifically in the House of Representatives, talk about Latinos.
But why would they not also get that vibe of hostility from an Obama administration that has presided over, in modern times, record numbers of deportations?
That worm is just now starting to turn. A lot of that was kept quiet, or at least spoken about in a lowered voice, because they thought President Obama was their best hope for comprehensive, and that the faster they got it, the sooner those deportations would end. Now we're in the fifth, entering the sixth year of the Obama presidency. He is, in the mouths of many Latino activists, the deporter-in-chief. He is going to surpass by far the record of any other two-term president for deportations. Those facts are starting to be more widely known, and the consequences of those facts are starting to be more widely understood. You know, Simon, there are millions of Americans living in mixed-status families. So it's not just a question of mom, dad, sister, and brother all being illegal, all being put on a plane, and all being sent back to central Mexico. You'll have a father who's not supposed to be here, married to a woman who is, or two parents who snuck across the border in their late teens or early 20s, but now have two citizen children, but citizen children who are minors, so can't use their own legal status to regularize their parents. 4.5 to 5.5 million people living in those mixed status families, and they are stories that are going to splash back on both parties if these deportations continue at this rate.
And I want to ask you another question about the administration's approach to the Latino community that seems to me still to speak volumes about the way in which they are viewed politically here. When the president a few weeks ago ran into trouble over Syria, and he decided to try and make the case for military intervention in Syria, he calls six television networks into the White House and sits down with six anchor men and women. And not a single one of them comes from a Spanish language television network. Now, if he wants to make a case about immigration reform, Univision is called in, Telemundo is called in. The Latino community surely cares about Syria as well. Isn't that a reflection of a political system that still hasn't fully understood the changing demographic nature of what's taking place here?
Since Telemundo and Univision are beating English language late local news in many markets across the country, it shows a kind of myopia about your press operation, for at the very least. And we should always remember that that large numbers of those 53 million people consume media almost solely in English for many of them, in a mix of Spanish and English for many of them, and some solely in Spanish. So aiming your outreach in a way that's going to capture them all, not as easy as it looks. But yes, there should have been Maria Elena Salinas and Jorge Ramos talking to the president and others, as well as Scott Pelley and Diane Sawyer and all that crowd.
Jorge Ramos, who I believe is the most watched Sunday talk show host in America, not something you'd know from Monday's papers.
Absolutely. And in part because that show, because a lot of people who watch the Sunday shows in order to get their lines and their quotes for their Monday morning wrap-up pieces don't know enough Spanish to know what the people on the program said.
All right. And Ray, we should mention that you have a new gig, a new job coming up. You are now an anchor for Al Jazeera America. Tell us a bit about that project.
Starting Monday, November 11th, I'm the host of Inside Story on Al Jazeera America. That's Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time. It's really an exciting development for me. I can't wait to get my arms in there up to my elbows and start working on this new show.
Terrific. Ray Suarez, the best of luck with that and with the book. It is called Latino Americans and is available in bookstores now. The documentary series of the same name, Latino Americans, can also be watched on demand at pbs.org. Ray Suarez, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to see you, Simon.
And that's our special Veterans Day edition of FSN Reports. Tomorrow we'll be back with our usual diet of news reports from our bureaus around the world. Let us know what you think of the program. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks in Washington with Nick Harper at the Bulletin Desk in New York today. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.